Okay. Good afternoon, or whatever time it is, wherever you're held up. Welcome to our grand experiment in online teaching, which my first time too. So, logistics, I'm going to try to do these lectures using Zoom. There will still be recordings. I expect that's what many people will end up relying on. Like, I know we have more than 78 registered for this class. I recommend exiting full screen and opening up the chat and participants window, which you may or may not be able to do without exiting full screen, but in the chat window, you can chat and I can see things. I will try to monitor it. Please keep it on topic. I don't mind if you talk amongst yourself about what we're actually showing on the slides, but let's not have like crazy off-topic conversations. The participant window has nonverbal feedback features. Most notably, you can raise your hand there, in which case you will float up to the top of the list for me, and I will know you if you have a question. There's also things like go faster, go slower, and for all those sorts of things, I just see an aggregate count of who it is. I can either, but I have to like scroll down in the giant list of names to see exactly who it is, so you're not going to get my attention personally, but it will tell me, hey, some people are confused or something. I'm going to try to monitor the chat window. We'll see today whether I need to like get a TA to do that for me. If you raise your hand, I can like unmute you to ask a question. I know some of you have horrible audio or like have some sibling construction site in the back of your audio or something like that, so text maybe more often easier option, but we can try audio and see how that works. I should be recording this both through Zoom and with a local recording similar to my usual setup for lecture recordings, but with some slight differences in how the audio works and on a different machine. Okay, and general logistics for the course. So lectures are streamed via Zoom. We can hopefully take questions in the middle and things like that. By doing this, we'll still have video and audio recordings and the slides available. I'm sorry I didn't actually post the slides until like 15 minutes ago, but they're up for this lecture. Since we have less in-person interaction, please try to use Piazza, especially since that's a better fit when people are in different time zones and so on. And you should try to use it more. Office hours, we settled on Discord with a queue. I was originally thinking we could use Zoom for it, but bizarrely, Zoom does not let meeting co-host manage breakout groups, so that plan did not work. We think the Discord plan will work reasonably well, as can be expected. And quizzes are still happening, though. Obviously, this week's quiz will probably cover less than we originally were planning on having it cover. So before I move on, any questions about logistics or so on? So a question, am I going to go over the midterm? I was not planning on doing so. You are definitely more than welcome to ask questions about the midterm on Piazza, especially if there are things which you don't think are clear from the key. I would like to edit the keys for future semesters to like actually have explanations of questions that are confusing to people. But I don't plan on doing it during this lecture time. You can also ask about the midterm during office hours, of course. Other questions? Do I know how the final will work? No, I don't. My thinking at this point is to do a take-home exam where you upload a text document to Kytos, but I have to figure out how that would work and whether that makes sense. Question, is this the first time I've done this level of online teaching? Yes. And has anything changed with the credit, no credit option? I'm waiting to hear what the full provost's policy is. Like, I assume what I do is I grade as usual, which means like getting the raw score at the end of the semester and assigning breakpoints like I would usually do, which usually is more generous than a C, meaning being 73%, depending on how like exams go. And then if you got a C or better in that, give you a credit or no credit, based on what the provost sent out. Usually when I do pass fail in this course, I set the threshold at C minus and not C, and I'm not sure whether that's what the provost meant but didn't say, or if they really mean a C. But I'm sure I'll find that out eventually. Other questions? The question is, will we have more work due 1 week in the future since some of our deadlines put back? I'm not sure I interpret that. We have, there's less breaks between assignments with the deadlines being pushed back. Previously we had like a long, we had a, like a week between some assignments, which isn't there anymore. Which is why I could just push the deadlines back. Okay, anything else? Okay, so let's talk about where we were last time. Way before all this, before the midterm, we were talking about virtual memory. We talked about this two-level table structure, and we introduced this idea that we could handle page faults, and we could handle them other than by segfaulting the program and killing it. And how the processor would help us is when we return from a page fault handler, it would retry the instruction that triggered the page fault. And if we did nothing, well, that would be pretty useless. We just go into an infinite loop. But if we didn't, if we like fixed the page table before we're returning, the instruction would work the next time. And we have these two tricks that are part of our current assignment. So one is this allocate on demand idea. And the idea with allocate on demand is we pretend to allocate right away and we lie to the program and say, yeah, I allocated that memory for you. And when the program tries to use that memory, well, it doesn't work. So it gets a page fault. We fix up the memory before we return and allocate it. And we have the similar idea with copy and write. We pretend that when they call fork to do the copy, but we actually like allocate the extra space for the copy and do the copy later. So this should be allocate plus copy later when the program tries to write, and the write is disallowed, you know, write detected because read only set in the page table entry. And to go into a bit more detail about this, so since we have the assignment coming up, so for allocate on demand, we're looking at how it's going to work in XV6. In XV6, we have to have some notion for this of like where, how much is allocated for the program? How much did we pretend and tell the program we allocated? And this is sort of what the size is for. This is the end of heap equals how much we pretended to allocate. So, on a page fault, we're going to use this amount we pretended to allocate when the program called sbreak to have either say, oh, we didn't pretend to give you that memory, so we're going to do what we did before and kill you, or to say, okay, that's fine. We're going to allocate that page for you and go back. And we also have copy on write. And in XV6, the way you'll implement this is that our setup is that we pretend to copy, probably should have this on, you know, setup, pretend to copy, but set read only. And this is on page fault. We have some cases. In one case, is that if they're trying to write a forbidden page, we do the normal thing. We don't make do copy everything the program tries to write and get a page fault for. We detect if they're trying to write something that's read-only, because, we set it that way on fork. And if so, fork, etc. And if so, we have two cases that you're going to probably be looking at when you implement this in XV6. So one case here is that if there's multiple entries that refer to it, you need to make a copy. And the other case, if only one refers to it, you can take the shortcut of just making it writable. You could also hypothetically make a copy and then remove the original, which might be easier but is a little slower. So questions about those things we covered before, allocate on demand and copy on write, before I move on to some new material. Question is, if we pass all tests, does it guarantee full credit? I assume you're asking about the paging assignment. This is not 100%. We'll do some more thorough things to try to look for subtle bugs. You should get almost all the credit, but we'll do things like check dump page table output for duplicate pages that shouldn't be duplicated, and we'll also run test cases which take much longer to run, which we don't give you because you probably would be annoyed if I gave you a 10-minute test case. But you should get almost all the credit if you pass all the tests. We don't want to surprise people, but we do want to check things. The question is, how can we tell if multiple things refer to the same read-only page for copy on write? You have to track that with some sort of data structure. In the assignment, we recommend making a big array with a reference count for each page, where the reference count is how many things refer to this page. And the assignment write-up talks about some ideas for that. The thing to be careful is you have to think of what thing ref types of references am I tracking and just be consistent about it. Am I tracking whether it's used at all or whether it's used for read-only stuff or what? But that's sort of the idea. And this is similar to what real OSs do. As we'll learn, there's actually a bunch of information real OSs want to track for physical pages. So they'll typically have some sort of data structure with data about each physical page with meta information like this that needs to be kept somewhere. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's go ahead and talk about something else, something really magical called mmap. So in Linux and Unix, there's this function which can map a file to memory. So here, I can open up a file for reading and writing and call this mmap function with the file descriptor I got from open. And I can read the file by accessing it like an array. And I can modify the array, and it modifies the actual file. This is really magical, and this is something that's enabled by virtual memory. So we're going to talk about how this works later. First, I'm going to talk about what the mmap call, actually looks like in this diagram here. I put dot dot dots, but something needs to go there. So mmap takes an address to map, address to map to, but that's not actually used very much. But most importantly, you have a length, how much to map from what file descriptor. So these are the two supports, our length and our file descriptor, and what offset in the file, whether the beginning or the middle, to map from. And it also takes some flags, which we'll talk about next, and protection flags, which say what type of access to the file do you want? Do you want to be able to read it, write it, execute machine code in it, or not do anything? And the idea is that you can just set it up for reading the file, for reading and writing the file, and you can also use this to load a program into memory. And if you think about how like programs get loaded into memory, you know, we like just load part of the executable at a particular memory location. This does exactly that operation if address works the way you might expect. And in fact, this is basically how that's implemented on Linux. So this is the same mechanism that's used to load executables we can actually use to get files in our memory for whatever we want. So we have our most important part, that we have our length, FD, and offset. So then we have this flags. And there's two types of mappings. There's shared mappings, which work the way I showed you in that first example, that when you change the memory, you change the file. And if the file changes, you immediately see the updates in your memory. The OS arranges that they're actually the same thing. And what we're going to learn this means under the cover is that you're going to get access to the same memory the OS is using to keep track of the file. And with a private mapping, you get a copy of the data in the file. Now, the OS could implement this private mapping by just copying the data right away, but it's not going to do that. It's going to do copy on write, because that's a lot faster. So typically, it's going to be as if you copied it, but it's actually going to be a copy on write mapping. So this, for example, and we'll see this like this use case later, if you have your section of your program that represents global variables, you can use mmap to load the initial value of those global variables and set it as a private mapping. So when you modify those global variables from their default values, the OS takes care of allocating memory then rather than right away when you are just using the initial values. So questions about how mmap works so far? Okay. So Linux supports an additional flag that is interesting besides this shared and private, which is ORed with shared or private, called anonymous. So in Linux, you can use mmap not just to map a file, you can use it to get memory. You can just say, I want you to give me a bunch of memory, but it's not part of a file. And the reason Linux does this is that the way Linux tracks a program's memory is a list of these mappings, and some of them have files and some of them don't. And this means that that's what a program's memory is. And this is the equivalent to what we saw with XV6 tracking the end of the heap. Linux, you know, supports more than just having a heap. There's other things you can do with your memory. So the way they track a program's memory is just as a list of these mappings. Now, I kind of glossed over this address argument, and you might think that's the address to put the mapping at, and it kind of is, but it's a suggestion about where to put the mapping. It's ignorable, and typically when you see mmap used in practice, programs will pass null to this saying, I don't care, put it somewhere, and the OS won't typically put it at the null pointer address, they'll put it somewhere else. There is an option to say, no, really use that address, even if it doesn't make sense, but typically programs don't use that except in special cases, like if you're writing something that loads an executable that expects to find its global variables at an exact address. Okay. So any other questions about mmap? So, if not apparently, we have a little exercise here, and let's look at this code that uses mmap and decide what we think the output should be, assuming no failures, and please ignore if I made like little syntax errors. So you can see here, we open this hello.txt, we map 3 bytes from offset 0 into 3 different places, P1, P2, P3, with different flags. We set P2, P1 somewhere, and then we read from the actual file. Question is, what do we expect the output to be? You should see a poll on your screen, some of you. Most of you, I hope. I'm not sure if everything works in like the web interface. I guess I'm still learning what I need to think about what answer rate I want to end this at. I think people still need more time. Are polls being graded? No, they are not. I'm doing this as a poll so I can get an idea of whether people are really confused. Okay, we're at I'll give a little more time. Okay. So I'll share the results. CM. Learned that doing that twice might be better. So a majority of us, majority of you, have concluded that this is the correct answer, which is what I got. So let's talk about the most common wrong answers and or goes on. So a lot of people wanted this answer here. And so that's different in the value of P3 from the actual answer. So the thing to remember about P3 is that it's a read-only, but it's a shared mapping. So this means that it always reflects the contents of the file. So that means that modifying the file by editing the other mapping that's shared must have changed what P3 is. So you might ask, how is that possible if this is read-write and this is read-only? And what's likely happening is that there's two different page table entries, one for P1 and one for P3, pointing to the same physical page, but with different metadata about whether it's readable or writable. So modifying through P1 also changed what was at memory at P3. Okay, so that's answer. And then we have C as the next most common answer. And so here we have the difference of saying, what about P2? Shouldn't P2 not contain fix2 because we modify the file? Remember that this is a private mapping, which means that it's copy on write. And we wrote here, so it's no longer going to reflect the file around that part of memory. It's going to reflect our new version, which contains FOB. And it's going to continue containing FOB. It's not going to ever update to reflect changes on the file after that copy happens. Okay. So any questions about this? So the question is, does the copy on write mean that if we first wrote to, that if we swap these lines, would we get different answers? And the answer is that POSIX doesn't say. POSIX allows the copy to happen earlier or later, so either could happen. So basically POSIX says you can do copy on write or you can copy immediately. So it allows both options. So it allows either result. And the question is, what would happen? And that's the question, like, what would happen if P22 happens after? So other questions? The question is, does copy on write copy when either the original or the copy gets written to? So traditional copy on write, like in fork, does that. For mmap, a shortcut is taken that they assume you don't care whether you read the file like it was when you called mmap or a little later, so they don't tell you when the copy happens. Don't tell you that the copy is going to happen if the original is modified, or not. But when we're talking about something like fork or multiple copy and write copies, we have to do that. Question is, can we specify a flag to copy immediately? POSIX doesn't provide one, but there's probably a way to tell Linux to do that. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I told you that Linux manages a program's memory as a list of memory mapped regions. And you can in fact view this with a special file in this /proc file system. So this says /proc is this magical directory that contains folders for every application. There's a special folder named self for the program that's trying to open it. So the cat program is opening this special maps file about itself. If I replace self with a PID, it would open it about a PID. And this file is just a dump of the kernel data structures that track what memory this program has allocated to it, or at least what memory that the kernel is pretending it has allocated, regardless of whether the program really is allowed to access, regardless of whether the program really has all of that set up in its page table right now. And, you know, this isn't labeled, but we'll go through what's in an entry here. So at the beginning, we have a range of virtual addresses. So this is saying virtual address hex 400000 through 40B000 is set up as readable, not writable, executable, and is a private mapping. So as if we use that private flag for copy and write. Now, this is a non-writable mapping, so the private flag doesn't really do anything, but Linux still keeps track of it. And then we have the offset and what file it is. So this is starting at offset 0 of the file bin cat, which is the actual executable code. So you can guess that since this is readable and executable, that means that this is how we're loading the cat program into memory to run its machine code. There's also this extra data here, which is about the file. So bincat is not actually how the kernel keeps track of the file. This is the information how the kernel knows what file it is. We'll talk about this more when we talk about file systems. So this whole thing is basically as if we did an mmap call like this. And that, and our address hint was used. I made a mistake here, not paying attention. This size, so this is size so the size is A or is B 00 and the offset is 0. I think I was thinking about the next one. So questions on this? Okay, so let's think about how this mapping works. So the simplest sort of way of implementing it is that we have that data structure that says we have this file mapped, and we just know from that data structure that the page tables are mapped. But we don't have to actually do anything to our page table to set this up. We can just leave it all invalid. And also, you know, because there might be multiple copies of cat, you know, we're going to have some file data, which is like the cat data, and we're going to have one copy of that, and we're going to keep the parts of it that are frequently used, what we'll say, cached in memory. And we'll talk about this idea that we're actually going to use our memory sort of as a cache, a place for frequently accessed data. Yeah, and that's how we're going to manage our memory. So with this setup, let's say our cat executable starts running and it tries to read from, say, the second page here. Since we didn't set up anything, we'll get a page fault. And the page fault handler, in this case, what it's going to do is that there's going to be some OS data structure which says, oh, that file, that part of that file, yeah, I have a copy of that already. It's at this physical page number, and we'll update the page table entry, return, and that access will work. It also could be the case that it tries to read from something which isn't actually cached in memory. In that case, the page fault handler is going to do an extra step of saying, okay, we need a copy of this cached in memory. Let's do that. Then we can now point to the new page. Okay. Giving us this result. And other things that are accessed will fill in as we need to. And this sort of idea I've shown you for read-only, and we can also use this to handle shared read-write maps. It's going to be the same way. There's going to be this copy of the file data that is the one copy we're going to use that's cached in memory, and we're just going to give the program access to it. And this in this case, if it's mapped this way, where we said read write, we're going to give it read write access, which means that it's going to be able to modify it. And if it writes to the data, well, it modified it, and the data on disk is out of date. And so there might be a little extra work we have to do. One thing we don't have to do is that other programs can get the modified data without any extra effort, because they're going to get it either through an mmap or by calling read. And we just need to make read use the cached versions, which is probably going to be the easiest thing. And otherwise, they've modified the same data the program's reading. Another step we have to do is that eventually we're going to want to free up this memory. And when we do that, we better write the updated data to disk, or else we'll be very disappointed that our disk file on disk doesn't actually get updated, even though it looked like it was updated. So questions about our page table update procedure for these, you know, simple mappings where we don't have any copy on write involved? So you might have seen here that we had two types of page faults. I'll get to your question in a bit. And we're going to divide them into two types. There's minor faults, which is a name we can use for this common page fault of the page fault handler still runs, but it's actually very easy. It looks up in a data structure, hey, here's the cache data, fills in a page table entry, it's done, versus major page faults, where it's not that way and we need to like actually do a process of finding a place to put the data, loading it from disk, and so on. Okay. The question is, in the exercise, could reading from the buffer potentially not be updated yet? So the question is talking about, okay, in the exercise, we modified this shared data and then the read happened. You know, and something which needs to happen to make this type of mapping works is that this data here is always used by read slash write. It has to be the same memory that read and write are going to use to access the file. They can't do something else. Does that answer your question? So you have this major and minor faults, and in fact, on Linux, you can get counts of this. So here, I ran a command, and it told me a bunch of statistics, and among them is the number of major faults and minor faults. So in this case, there were no major faults because the command, in fact, I had ran it recently, and all its data that it needed to run was loaded into memory. But there were 230,000 minor faults for those like setting things up changes. Okay. So let's look at the more complicated case of copy on write. And copy on write mappings we see here in our cat executable, you know, we have this region mapped as copy on write, and I've hopefully set up, yeah, so it's one page worth of data, the size at this offset is mapped as copy on write, we know it's private, and this is probably used for global variables. So the idea is that for some of the global variables, the executable contains the initial values of those global variables, but they could be changed, and we're going to use copy on write to handle that. So in this case, that's how the executable is loaded. So if we never change the global variables from the default value, we save memory and time. So the way that works is going to start the same as what we saw for the non-copy on write mappings. We're just going to have our file data cached in memory and so on, but this is going to be a read-only mapping. So if we try to write to one of these pages, we're going to get a fault because the page table entry is going to say read only. And the fault handler is going to make a copy and update the page table. And we're going to have to keep track of these copies because we went like eventually went to free them and so on. So that's another sort of data structure for the kernel to manage. So questions about our copy on write procedure? Question is, would you lose the original read-only copy? So after we make this copy, the OS is allowed to like deallocate this memory. You know, can deallocate. But we don't lose the copy because we always have, you know, the original here. So, and that's the reason it can just deallocate that, because if it deallocates it and we decide that that was a bad idea, we can read it from disk again. That answer your question? Okay, so now that we talked about how Mac work, let's go through another exercise. And I'll go to the setup first. So let's say we have this range of virtual addresses mapped to the same amount of data from a file, and it's a copy on write mapping. And let's say that initially the OS has part of this file in memory already, but part of it it's going to need to read. So it has this part and this part. I notice that those are whole pages and inclusive ranges of bytes. Let's say the program does two things. So first it reads this range of bytes, and then it overwrites this range of bytes. And assume that we fill in page table entries on demand. So you might observe that I was saying, you know, we wait until there's a page fault for a particular page to look up the cached entry. You might say, you know, maybe we could guess that if you're accessing, you know, 3800 and 4400, you're going to need the next page. Real OSs will sometimes do that. Let's assume we're not doing anything special like that. We just only do it on demand at the last possible moment. And my question here is how many page and protection faults? So this is both the stuff, both to set up the page as read-only, you know, both for the read-only version plus the copy. And we'll set that up here. I suppose I'm giving the bytes of the file that are read. I probably should have used the virtual addresses since I talked about that, but I didn't. You can't change the answer once you submit. That is unfortunate. Okay, right. Window disappears, so yeah. Okay, I think we have a quorum. Gonna do it this way. Okay, so the majority of you say three. Which is not correct, but it looks like you're getting the first part right. So, what happens here is first, we need to set the PTE for this range of the file, which is cached. And we do that because this is part of the page, this is one page. One page, and we start by reading some bytes in that page. We can only load the whole page, so we load the whole page by setting the page table entry to that already cached data. Then the program moves on to the next page, so we need to set a PTE for the page containing the next range of bytes. And also, as part of that, we need to actually read from disk because it's not cached. And we have the following range of bytes, so this was cached, this is cached, and this here is not cached. But then we have our overwrites part. When we set these initially, these are going to be read-only because we want to do copy and write. And I think what most people probably missed is that we initially make it read-only. We initially guess you aren't doing a copy and wait until you actually try to write to actually make the copy. And so that's where other two faults happen. When we do these overwriting, there's two pages that are modified. Even though it's only a little part of the second one, two pages are modified, and we have to do the copy for those both of those two pages. So questions on this answer? How does caching affect the faults for 2 and 3? So for 2, so I guess, the fault for 2 reads from disk. That's how it affects it. The other ones don't read from disk because of caching. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Question is, does this mean in terms of faults, the cache is basically invisible? Yeah, the program doesn't even notice the page faults. They're invisible to the program, but yeah, whether or not the data is cached, under this model that we fill in the page table on demand only, assuming we don't try to take a shortcut there, we're going to have the same number of faults overall, just some of them will be more or less expensive depending on what we keep cached in memory. Okay, other questions? Okay, so talked about our memory mappings. And one thing I mentioned that we see here is that there's special mapping. So the heap is special in Linux. That's why it's listed here. But it's the same as doing an mmap call with no file, which we actually see examples of here, where the program has set up to get a region of the file set up as read-write and anonymous, where they didn't specify a real file descriptor. So how does this work? Well, Linux treats it, and most Unix-like OSs treat this actually pretty much the same way as a file mapping. So we have our data in memory for this region that we allocated, and we allocate that on demand typically. So these pages which haven't been accessed don't have any data in memory and don't have anything on disk. Now you might just notice I have this box marked data on disk swapped out. We're actually going to do this thing where even for data that doesn't have a natural place on disk, doesn't have a file it belongs to, we're going to assign one. And this is going to be known as swapping. That we're going to make sure we can place any data on disk, and this is going to let us do the same thing we do to manage file data for all data in memory. That everything, we're just going to say, you know, it has a place on disk, it has a file it belongs to, either a real file or one we just made up for the purpose. So with this mapping, you know, we're going to access some memory, and this is where allocate on demand happens, that we don't have a file to load from, but we're still going to allocate space for data and assign it to the program in its page table so it works. And if we need more memory, we're going to be able to deallocate some of this space the program is using by assigning it a place on disk to hang out. When we do that, we make the program's mapping temporarily invalid. And later on, if the program tries to access that again, we just have to remember, oh, right, I put that on disk. Let me get that for you and update your page table. So questions about this swapping idea? On demand. And I showed you swapping for something like the heap and so on. So what the difference here is that between the graphics earlier is that in the original case, our main version of the file data was always on disk. So for these cache data, this was cached because it was actually like a copy of data here being temporarily kept in memory. But in this case, we only allocate the space on disk as we need it, or only use it. We don't have to worry about keeping this up to date. Once we load the data back into memory, we just keep it there. We're not going to need to update disk. We don't have a guarantee that disk gets updated. And the question is this the swap partition on Linux? Yes, this data on disk is known as the swap partition in Linux, or the paging file on Windows, and probably some other names on the various other OSs. So other questions or follow-ups? Okay, so I showed you this sort of, question is, what is this used for? This is how Linux is gonna manage things like the heap and other memory that isn't from a file. That we're gonna use the same type of mechanism that we would use for data that's mapped from files, except that we're gonna like create temporary files when we would want to put data on disk. Does that answer your question? Okay. So the question is, disk refers to what exactly? By disk, I mean some persistent storage, like a hard drive, SSD, etc. The question is, how is this different from using malloc? So malloc is going to allocate one of these regions on this list. And that's all I'm going to give you parts of that. That's all malloc does. That memory actually being usable is going to happen, like we see here, as you try to use it. Does that answer your question? Okay. So this swapping I showed you, question is, so malloc is higher level than mmap and uses mmap? Basically, yes. So I showed you the swapping for when we have, you know, just something allocated to the program. This swapping also happens for our private mappings. So let's say here I was doing my copy on write thing where I have some locally modified copy of a private mapping. So we have this read-only version here, but we have this thing we wrote to that we made a copy for. And if the OS needs a lot of memory, well, the first thing it can do is it can get rid of all this cached file data. We can get rid of that pretty easily because we know, well, it's the same thing that's already on disk. I can get it back if I need it. And if the OS still needs more memory, it might want to get rid of this copy here and stash it on disk temporarily. And this is, in fact, something operating systems do. That if we need more space, we want to free up that copy of the file data. And just like for things which weren't in a file, we need to make a home for this. So we're going to allocate some temporary space to store the copy the program was using. And we have to remember about that so we can get it back if the program tries to access that again. Some questions about this procedure. Okay, so this idea of swapping, which is, if you remember talking about memory hierarchies in an earlier course, I'll get to your question first. So why can't we place it in the file data correctly? Because this is a copy for a private mapping. So, you know, so this is being, you know, used by other programs. Each should have own copy. So to make sure each program has its own copy, we don't want to modify the original file. We want to like allocate a new file on demand for the modified data. Does that answer your question? Okay, so this idea of swapping, so one way you can think about it is if you remember learning about caches in some prior course, might have been a while, especially some of you, that we have this memory hierarchy idea where we have like cache that on the processor that makes DRAM, the normal memory chips, faster. We can have the OS sort of use DRAM, normal memory, as a cache for actually disk and so on, where the idea is that all of our data conceptually belongs to either a file on disk or some dynamically allocated space on disks or SSDs or other slower but much bigger storage. And memory is just keeping the most recently used parts, or the most useful parts of that around. And swapping, you know, we can think of as being very similar to mmap, is that like it's like you mmap with, you know, default files to use, so we handle the things where there's not a file. And this idea of swapping and the next level of the memory hierarchy is actually one of the motivations for virtual memory. And many other introductions to virtual memory start with, this is what we're doing. I didn't do that because although this works, the performance of actually doing a lot of this swapping out and moving back in is not great. And we don't like doing it these days because, you know, a disk or even an SSD is way, way slower than main memory. And you, if you're doing this a lot, your system will run really slow. And the main use of this functionality in modern OS is shuffling data between files, sort of loading files dynamically and so on, even though that was maybe not the original design of what virtual memory would primarily be used for. Okay. Yeah, and as I guess it's because these things that we're backing for are slow. And by slow, I mean, you know, milliseconds or hundreds of microseconds. That doesn't feel slow, but compared to, you know, actually like reading 4 kilobytes in a loop, it's real slow. And so what often we call what we're doing with memory when we have this design is what we call memory the page cache. That memory is a cache for disk. All this stuff has a place on disk. And both files and program memory, are things that have a place on disk. And physical memory, that we just set up pages to temporarily keep things that really have a place on disk in faster storage. So, you know, parts of, you know, things that might be used by more than one process and so on, but we're just keeping things in faster storage. And we're going to look at this view of memory as a cache and talk about how do we manage this cache intelligently. And we're going to go through some concepts which, you know, might be familiar if we remember talking about processor caches in a prior course, which I know it's variable depending on whether you took the ECE course or not. But we're going to talk about how can we manage this intelligently. And also, you know, just how can we keep track of the information we need to keep track of to make this happen. So I'm going to talk about what information are we going to track. And I'm going to have this overall diagram. I know this is really complicated. I'm going to break this down into pieces. So let's start with the first case. So we have this idea that memory is a cache. And a cache hit means we're accessing the fast storage, which is memory. And we have some data structure that lets us do that. And there's two on this picture. So one is that if a program is accessing a virtual address, its cache hit is it gets a page table entry lookup, and that works. So this is managed by the hardware for programs. We also have to do the same thing for reads and writes. So when we read or write from a file, the OS is going to check its cache and access the physical memory that already has the data rather than actually going to disk if it can, and that's going to be a cache hit for our read or write call. So this virtual address cache hit is going to, you know, be done by the hardware, which means that when we're doing that with a page table, you know, how that works is determined by the hardware. The OS doesn't really have a choice. It needs to do whatever makes the hardware make those accesses work. Now, for the process of going from a file and a location in a file to the page, which we need both for read or write and to also fill in the page table, as we'll find out, like, we can choose whatever data structure we like because the hardware doesn't know about this. Not its concern, so we can design this however we like. So one example, that's roughly what Linux does, is that you can use a balanced tree that has entries for each of the things that are cached and has holes where there aren't things cached as for, you know, a big file. So on Linux, you know, all this data is kept for each sort of process. So we have in Linux our process control block, and like in XV6, we have a pointer to the page table. So the page table, that's what we're using when we're writing a program and we need to do a lookup for a virtual address. We just look up in the page table. If there, that's a cache hit. And we also have the case of read or write. And in Linux, kind of like XV6, there's an array of open files. And there's some indirection because there's multiple types of open files. So read or write is going to check the open file information. And not all open files represent files on disk. But for those which do, there's a structure representing a file on disk, which has a pointer to a data structure representing here's the cache data for that file. So another case which comes up is that we have to fill in this page table. And that's sort of going to use our list we saw earlier of what maps does the program have. So there's this map of regions the program has access to, and we're going to go from that to information about a file to its cache data to fill in the page table. And that's how we populate the page table in a case where it's technically a miss because it wasn't in the page table, but we had it cached, you know, so it's that minor page fault, that fast miss. So questions about this diagram? Okay, so you know, we're talking there about calling this data. Now, this is the case for a hit, you know, and the sort of pseudo hit of, well, it's not in the page table, but we can bring it into the page table using our file plus offset information. But we also need to think about what happens when we need to load new data. So, you know, we're going to have two parts we're going to need to talk about. So one part, which I'm going to skip for right now, is that we need to figure out a physical page to put it in. And the easy case would be there's some unused page, let's just put it there. That often doesn't work out. When we're running our system for a while, we'll have lots of files that have been accessed, and we'll eventually use up all of memory. And that's a good thing, because the more memory we use to cache file data, the faster reading files is going to be in general. So often we'll have to figure out, choose a page and remove whatever is in there. And we'll talk about how that works later. But the other thing we need to do is we need to like load the data into the page we choose, which means we need to have a way of knowing the location of the data. So the way that works is that we have our virtual address mapping to a disk location and the file offset mapping to a disk location. And for this virtual address to a disk location, this is something that's done by the OS. The hardware, all it knows is that it does a page fault and suddenly the OS knows what to put in the page table entry. So this is all the OS's choice, and the hardware doesn't know about read or write, so this file offset to this location is all the OS's choice. So in our cache miss, we're going to look up the location, either because a read or write was called or because of a page fault, and figure out, you know, what the data is, and then we're going to load it into some physical page and update these other mappings. Question might be, is like, how do we actually maintain this mapping? So we're not going to talk today about how we do the file and offset to a disk location. We're going to talk about that a lot when we talk about file systems. For the other part, we've kind of seen how Linux does it for parts of files, that we have this list of memmap regions. So in that case, we look up which region are you in, figure out the file, and use this other file system mapping. For swapped out things, we have a different trick that's very common, which is that we're actually going to use part of page table entries. So for our mmap regions, you saw in my diagram before, we had this struct vm area, which just contains this information and this pointer to the backing file, plus the offset and so on is going to let us figure out what location to look up on disk. For things that are swapped out, which don't have a file, where we don't have this set file data structure, what Linux has chosen to do is to use ignored parts of the page table entry. So remember when we talked about the page table entry format, I told you if it's not present, that this whole thing is ignored. What Linux does is it just puts the information about where on disk it is here. Because the hardware doesn't care what you put there. Okay. So question is, what's the difference between a physical page and memory and physical disk? So these physical pages I'm talking about are always in memory. You know, memory, DRAM. And versus things on disk are going to be in some sort of persistent storage like a hard drive or an SSD, which we can't access the same way we do as memory directly. What's that? So the question is, so page tables are always assumed to be cached. So yes, so in our model, you know, everything that's in a page table is cached data that could have been on disk. But cache in memory for performance. Does that answer your question? Okay. So other questions about how we're maintaining this information about where the data actually is. So then we have this, I'll go on to other steps we had for loading data into our cache. So we talked about how do we find where to load it from. We had the relatively easy case of figuring out it's part of a file. We know what part of file should be at that virtual address or read from that location, get it, or it's swapped out. We look in the, we stashed it away when we swapped it out so we can look up that information. We also need to remove whatever was in that page if we have chosen to put it where there was already data. And this is a bit tricky because we saw earlier, I told you about, oh, you know, we have some cached data and we can get rid of that data to, you know, save, free up memory, but that cached data might be referenced by a page table. And if we're loading something else there, what's known as replacing it with something else, we better fix that. So we'll take what we call a victim page and remove it from every page table it's referenced by, every list of file pages, because we have all those forward mappings which we want to get and validate to put something else in that physical page. That physical page has one thing cached now, we want a different thing cached. We better make sure nothing after we do this thinks the old thing is still cached there. And this is going to require us to have some way of finding all the page tables and other things that are referencing this page. Also, we need to detect, do we need to like save it to disk or something like that? So we're going to talk about that. Now, this whole process is pretty expensive and we don't want to keep doing it. So we're going to mention considerations of, we're going to have to find those pages. We'll get to that later. But the evictions, so how do we figure out, you know, removing these pointers? We have a page we want to, you know, move back to disk so we can put something else in it. It has page tables pointing to it. It has this file tracking data structure pointing to it. And the most common solution here is that we're going to have some data structure that goes from given a page, tells us what files is it in, what virtual addresses is it being used by, and what programs. And typically, the way this is done is you have a data structure for each physical page with info about everything that's using that page. And there are some tricks you might do because this is obviously could be a lot of information to track. And in fact, OSs are trying to be careful about like not tracking too much. So on Linux, there's this struct page, and there's basically just an array of these structs about each page that point to here's where it's used, you know, so we can look it up. So for a page that's part of a file, it points to the cache data for the file, and that cache data for the file points to all the mmaps of the file so we can locate them and update all the page tables and this cache data. And we're going to need something similar for non-file data, which, you know, have to do some similar sort of data tracking for each page. So questions about this reverse lookup and sort of why we need to do it. Okay, so I told you about the mechanics of replacing a page, and we saw that this process is pretty expensive. So one thing we want to do is we want to choose a page that's not being used much. And I think, not surprisingly, I got through less than I got through on this lecture in prior semesters, but that's fine. So we'll pick up next time talking about how do we choose something that's a good choice. We don't want to choose something that's about to be used and have to do this process again and again. And to do that, this means we're going to have additional data structures about how a page is used. We're going to talk about what those look like next time. So before I finish up, any final questions? Okay, so I think that's